shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate.
And if I could write iambic pentameter, you'd be listening verily to Ye Olde Twipcast episode of the 14th IndyCast.
Regardeth Sir Henry James II, Earl of Indiana.
Today, I'd like to introduce you to James Caswell III, executive producer of Twipcast, writer extraordinaire, and belch champion of Upper West Aurora.
And I'm proud to introduce Doug Zeitlin, lifelong Cub fan and president of CFU, Cub Fans United.
Today, we'll be talking about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. We'll also be talking about the three previous movies and the prequel, The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
Now, we do feel the necessity to inform you from the very beginning that this episode will be filled with spoilers. If you have not yet seen the new Indiana Jones film and plan to, and don't want the major plot points to be ruined for you, pause this now. This is your last warning.
Welcome back. Glad to have you here. Sorry that we didn't warn you earlier about the movie, but nevertheless,
we figured if we had to suffer through it, so did you.
Yes, misery does love company. Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about the creation of this character, Indiana Jones, who's become kind of a modern icon for archaeology.
Back in the late 1970s, there was a man by the name of George Lucas. He had just created what would later become known as one of the very first blockbuster films, called Star Wars. He had created the movie with one simple principle in mind. He wanted to recreate the feeling of the science fiction serials from the 1930s, and he did a phenomenal job of it. He was on vacation, met up with a friend of his named Steven Spielberg, and pitched the idea of putting together a modern take on the 1930s action serials, and came up with the idea of Indiana Smith. Steven said that he was interested in doing a James Bond film, considered Indy to be a Bond without the hardware, and decided that he wanted to work with his friend on this project with the stipulation that the surname be changed. He didn't want him to be Smith, he wanted him to be Jones. Thus, the partnership behind Indiana Jones was created. Lucas worked with Kaufman to develop the arc aspect of the story, cut out some of the original ideas that Lucas had from the first movie, and created Raiders of the Lost Ark. I don't think that even they had any idea of the impact that they were creating on Hollywood at the time. From the very first movie, Indiana Jones became well known for a lot of iconic trademarks. The bullwhip, the fedora, the leather jacket, the fear of snakes, and perhaps even more famous above all of those, the theme music. I know that for the past 3 weeks I'll be at work, and all of a sudden I realize that I'm humming, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-
far as whether or not they knew what they were creating, in some ways, I'm sure that they really did intentionally use iconic images because these were things that the 1930s serials had. When you think of the 1930s Flash Gordon, you know that cigar-shaped spaceship is the Flash Gordon spaceship. The image of the ray gun has been reused in everything from Star Wars to Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow. I really think they were trying to come up with these iconic images. In the newest movie, Lucas and Spielberg were about as subtle as a tsunami in Asia. They've got the motorcycle, the greaser jacket, the hair comb with the perfect hairstyle, and the switchblade knife. You're supposed to go, oh, Indiana has a whip, but Mutt has the switchblade. Ooh, cool.
You mentioned that you think that they did this on purpose. And now that I've seen the new one, the question that floats to the top of my mind is, was the success of Indiana Jones a fluke? Did they stumble across this wonderful thing in Raiders of the Lost Ark purely by accident? If it so pleases the court, let me produce the evidence. A lot of the things that made Raiders of the Lost Ark successful were other people's ideas. Kaufman brought in the idea of using the Ark of the Covenant. Spielberg had to talk Lucas out of using the Monkey King and instead using the Holy Grail for the third movie. I don't think anybody tried to talk him out of doing Temple of Doom, which in and of itself is a mistake. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, using the gun instead of doing sword play was Harrison Ford's idea. Because he was suffering from the stomach flu, he didn't want to have to do this long, drawn-out fight, so he suggested, let me just shoot him. Temple of Doom was much darker because both Lucas and Spielberg were right in the middle of a divorce at the time. Now, I'm fully willing to admit that a lot of really good work is collaborative, that other people bring in ideas, they shoot down the bad ones, they contribute to make better ones. We go through this all the time in writing our TWRP stuff.
Where's the good ideas?
Well, I'm still waiting for somebody to come forward and offer them.
Okay, just making sure.
But it really feels as though they kind of stumbled across the right ingredients of making a good action flick. And I don't think that they've mastered it yet.
I'm glad that you mentioned a lot of good work comes out of the collaborative process. For the most part, non-independent movies are a collaborative effort between the producers, the directors, the writers, the studios. I mean, there is a huge effort that goes into making a small film. These are not small films. Whether or not it was a fluke is harder to answer. When you look at George Lucas's record as a writer, you've got American Graffiti, which is an American classic. You have Star Wars, which is an international classic. But you have things like Howard the Duck and Star Wars The Phantom Menace, which are piles of poopy. And then you come across Steven Spielberg, and here is a man who, in the beginning of his career, is an absolute genius. Jaws redefined the movie-going process. Jaws is the first blockbuster movie. To follow the success of a movie like Jaws with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, with E.T. the Extraterrestrial, with Raiders of the Lost Ark, makes him really look like he's just a master of his art.
Everything that he touched at that point in time turned to gold.
And in the modern time, he still has the touch of gold. Saving Private Ryan is at least the modern classic war movie. I think it was overrated, but it certainly wasn't a bad movie.
Schindler's List, 15 years later, is still considered the pinnacle tribute to the Holocaust.
I don't know how you can really reconcile Spielberg's successes with movies like Artificial Intelligence, Minority Report, and probably worst of all, the big stinking poopy pile called War of the Worlds. That was a really incredibly bad movie. Not just a bad Spielberg movie. That was just bad.
Yeah, that large earthquake that we felt 2 years ago, that was Orson Welles rolling over in his grave.
Both the Welles, Orson and H.G. So you have this classic movie archetype created by Lucas and Spielberg, which have two fantastic movies, one pretty piss-poor movie, and then Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which by far is better than Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. By the standards of the two good movies, doesn't really hold up.
I will say right off the bat that I could easily sit through 2 hours of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, whereas it's painful to sit through 10 minutes of Temple of Doom.
Well, I don't know if it's just indicative of modern movies to appeal to mediocrity. Are they just trying to appeal to an even larger audience, or was it just really not that good? It's hard to tell because, again, you've got the creator of Star Wars, the biggest money-making science fiction extravaganza ever, the creator of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T., Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan. I mean, these are really, really smart people. So are they intentionally being mediocre, or did it just end up that way?
I think that part of it is that they've become out of touch with what movie fans, and especially fans of their work, are looking for. Once again, we'll look back at Star Wars The Phantom Menace. Star Wars fans were waiting 20-plus years for a new Star Wars, and that is what he gave them.
Still, it made money. When you look at it in terms strictly of how much money it pulled in from merchandising, from international and domestic sales, for every measure of success, except for fan enjoyment, that movie was phenomenal.
But when your fan base is disappointed, you've done something wrong.
As a movie fan, I would agree with that, but as product of a capitalist society, that's not an accurate statement. The name of the game is make money, not build a fan base.
But if you take into consideration the number of times fans have gone to see the original trilogy over and over and over again, imagine how much the profits would have been if it had actually been good.
I don't know that I can argue with that. I think the test will be a movie like J.J. Abrams' new Star Trek movie. If this alienates the fan base, but generates a huge amount of money, will that be a success or a failure?
Like you said, time will tell.
Before we formally go into the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, why don't we say just a sentence or two about what we like and don't like of the original three movies?
Okay. Raiders of the Lost Ark, released in 1981. A groundbreaking movie. It literally redefined the genre of the action film. Using our scale, 4 out of 4. Pens in the pen protector.
I agree with that completely. Raiders of the Lost Ark was the perfect movie. It was a movie that came out at the perfect time. It had the perfect cast, had the perfect story. So definitely 4 pence in the pocket protector.
Followed in 1984 by Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Otherwise known as What Were You Smoking?
It took me 10 years after the movie was released to learn that it was a prequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark. It never actually dawned on me that this took place before Raiders. And even in knowing it, it didn't make it any better for me. 1 pen in the pocket protector.
I give it 1 pen halfway filled with ink in the pocket protector. And the only reason it gets that is because I can't give Harrison Ford 0. Temple of Doom is basically just the opposite of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's just not a fun movie. It's darker than Raiders of the Lost Ark. It really explores a mythology and an iconology that are literally foreign to the average American, which is not a bad thing to do. But if you're going to do that, you should pull the audience more into it. I don't want to say you have to spoon-feed them, but if you're going to give them a concept which they're unfamiliar with, you should do a better job of explaining it. Indiana Jones is a professor. This is a movie that, although I own the DVD, I have never broken the virginity of my DVD player by putting it in there.
As I mentioned earlier, the ideas that they considered bad for Raiders of the Lost Ark, they put into this movie.
I do have one good thing to say about that. By using up all of the bad ideas in the Temple of Doom, it meant they had to start fresh with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Brought out in 1989, starring Sean Connery. I mean, starring Harrison Ford and Sean Connery.
I think you had it right. Sean Connery really kind of stole the show in that movie. And that's nothing against Harrison Ford. He's a fantastic actor. But all the best lines really went to Sean Connery in this movie.
Yeah, Sean Connery was just excellent. And I was so sad to not see him in Kingdom of Crystal Skulls. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, 5 out of 4 pens in the pen protector. I'm going to cram an extra one in there just because it was so good. It is so rare for a sequel to outclass the original.
The Last Crusade is one of those cases of lightning striking twice in the exact same place. Here it is again. You've got the script, which is perfect, and the cast that just meshes together. Is it possible for the perfect storm to hit twice? Apparently it is, because this is definitely a 5 pens in the pocket protector out of 4. One of my favorite lines in the movie is when Henry Jones Sr. is like, "Junior," and he's like, "Don't call me that. I'm Indiana. We call the dog Indiana." And I'm just like, yes! Because for those who don't know, Spielberg's dog is Indiana.
The movie was titled The Last Crusade. It was quite clear that they really intended it to be the last in a trilogy. And in some ways, I almost wish that it was. Now, I will preface all of my future comments about Kingdom of the Crystal Skull by saying I didn't hate it. It was far superior to Temple of Doom. But it was no Raiders. It was no Last Crusade. I really wish that the series had ended on a high note. Of course, if they do an Indiana Jones 5, they still have a chance of going out on a high note, and I hope they take it. But this was no high note.
You hit the nail right on the head with the Indiana Jones 5 comment. This was Spielberg's Phantom Menace. Clearly, this was meant to be the beginning of a new trilogy. The introduction of the new character, Mutt, who is supposed to be the replacement for Indiana, which I think is a great in-joke considering that Indiana is Berg's Mutt. The fact that Mutt is also Henry Jones III comes as no shock in this movie. Again, Lucas's script is so transparent, it's telegraphed, it's whatever euphemism you want to use. There's no shocks or surprises in it at all. In addition, I'm going to agree with your first statement and tell people before I rip this movie a new one that as a fan of the original trilogy, I enjoyed it and I think it has its place in the Indiana Jones world. I'm still going to rip it a new one.
Let's hit the things that we'd like to first.
Because they're going to be a lot shorter?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds like a plan. I can tell you all 3 scenes that I like, and sorry that I'm going to do spoilers for you, but 2 of the car chase scenes, the first using Harrison Ford's hot rod out of American Graffiti. The second one that I enjoyed was the introduction of Mutt and his motorcycle at the university where Indiana Jones teaches. And the third scene was the quicksand scene. Starts out with Marion and Indiana stumbling into a sinking sand pit. At which point, Mutt says, "Is that quicksand?" And while Indiana Jones and Marion are facing this life-or-death situation, he's got to say, "Well, no, this is actually dry sand." And give the entire lecture on why quicksand and dry sand are often confused with one another. From that moment forward, it's like a 5-minute laugh fest.
Indiana Jones slips from daring archaeologist and adventurer back into university professor. And it's priceless. The change in his face, his tone of voice, it's like he's standing in front of a lecture hall as he's sinking into this sand pit.
That's a really good analogy. It reminds me of the 1978 Superman movie when Clark Kent takes off his glasses and goes, "Lois, I'm really..." And just by taking off his glasses and changing his demeanor, he changes from Clark Kent to Superman without putting on a cape. And this scene is equal to the challenge.
A lot of my favorite scenes place this movie firmly within the continuity of the Indiana Jones universe. References to previous movies, references to the television series, things that bring you back and say, see, this is part of a grand universe, and we're paying tribute to it. Those by far were my favorite scenes. While you could easily take and cut out the first 10 minutes of this movie for me, the scene in the warehouse where you actually see the Ark of the Covenant again, because this is where they've been stashing everything that Indiana Jones has ever found in this warehouse. And yes, they show the Ark of the Covenant again. They make references to the young Indiana Jones Chronicles. There's a scene where Indy is speaking an off-dialect of Spanish, and he makes reference to the fact that he was once kidnapped by Pancho Villa, which is directly out of the TV series. These little things, they're tidbits, they're Easter eggs. But they really made the movie feel as though it was part of this universe for me, and I really enjoyed them.
I'd actually go one step further and say it's those scenes that made the movie watchable. That the actual overall story was mediocre. It didn't draw you in the way Raiders or The Last Crusade did.
I hate to say this because it's going to sound like I'm beating my religious drum, but they really did need to have another artifact that is more recognizable, something that people on a grand scale have heard of, and not something that you literally need to see another TV show to have it explained to you before you go and see the movie.
Actually, that's a really interesting point, and I hadn't even thought of this until literally you said beating my religion drum. The previous three movies had very religious themes. Even if you aren't familiar with the religious themes from the Temple of Doom, there is a religious overtone in there. But Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, whereas they're certainly not religious movies, one of the main assumptions of those movies is these artifacts were actually created by God. Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, in its own way, contradicts that by saying that essentially man was taught many of his early skills, such as agriculture and herding animals and things like this, by aliens. In its own small way, contradicts the other movies.
In Raiders of the Lost Ark, it was the Ark of the Covenant. In Temple of Doom, the big artifact were three magical rocks. Last Crusade is the Holy Grail, or the Cup of Christ. This one deals with 13 crystal skulls, which apparently is part of the Mayan culture, though I honestly hadn't heard anything of it before I heard the name of the movie.
Unfortunately, I'm not familiar enough to go into the history lesson of what the crystal skulls are. There are about 7 real crystal skulls that nobody knows how ancient civilizations made because they're too perfect. That even using technology that we have today, that would either be impossible to make or incredibly expensive to make. And there really is a legend that there's 13 of these, and when they bring all 13 together, otherworldly creatures, whether they be aliens or extra-dimensional creatures, are going to come and they're going to save humanity and they're going to share their technology and their wealth with us.
You're talking about favorite points. And I'd mentioned that it included the young Indiana Jones Chronicles into the continuity. The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles aired on ABC from March 4th, 1992 to July 24th, 1993. And it dealt with a lot of historical events and tying Indiana Jones into those events. They made reference to actual people, actual places. Personally, I thought that one of the big downfalls of the series, though, was that it was far more historical fiction than it was action fiction. Indiana Jones is known for the archaeology aspect of things, but this felt more like the archaeology professor than the adventurous archaeologist.
I think the point of the television show was to show the other side of Indiana Jones and how this action star can actually be a tenured professor at an acclaimed university because he does have this knowledge, he does have this background. And although it certainly is the furthest thing from action-adventure, it's a really fun television series. And I think its weakest point is this historical aspect, because pretty much any famous person in the early 20th century, Indiana Jones either knew them personally, or rescued them, or was rescued by them.
In the movies, the closest Indiana Jones came to a encounter with a famous person is when Hitler takes the Grail Diary and autographs it. And it's not even really an interaction type of thing. It's just Indy happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and gets away with it.
Oh, God. That is probably one of the funniest scenes in all four movies. I think it was really interesting the way they switched from Nazis in the early era movies to Soviets in the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. It fits with the quote-unquote modernization because we were in the height of the Cold War in the setting for this movie. That being said, the use of the Soviets was also a weaker point in the movie. First of all, they do keep calling them Russians. Even though Cate Blanchett herself is identified as Ukrainian and not a Russian, they over and over again call them Russians and never call them properly Soviets, which is what they would have been in 1957. To say one more thing about the Soviets, if the actual KGB had ever been as good as this fictional KGB, there is no way America would have won the Cold War. I mean, these guys were in Area 51, they were at nuclear testing grounds, they were at American universities. I mean, pretty much anywhere that you couldn't get as a Soviet citizen, these guys could get.
And we're not even talking deep undercover KGB agents. We're talking ones who speak with such thick Russian accents that they start walking towards Indy and he goes, "Ah, these must be CIA." And they say two words and he goes, "Nope, KGB."
And yet they weren't the worst part of the whole movie. There are two scenes entirely which have to be cut from this movie for me to suspend my disbelief. As I said, the KGB agents were actually at a nuclear testing site, and so was Indiana Jones. The KGB agents, their car, the entire testing site is completely obliterated. But Indiana Jones gets in a lead-lined refrigerator, and he's able to survive the atomic blast and the flight that this refrigerator takes. But essentially, they said, yes, this was an unbelievable situation, and we just deus ex machina him.
Although I will say that whole scene did lead to a chuckle. When he's in the radiation shower and they're trying to clean him down and the guys are scrubbing him with scrub brushes and the scrub brush drops down and Anna Jones turns and gives the guy a dirty look and grabs a hold of the brush and brings it back up again because he didn't really like having this brush going across his private parts. It was childish, it was immature, it was a groin joke, but it was funny. Did it save the scene? No way.
It was lowbrow humor at its lowest, but it was enjoyable. But the second scene that really has to go for me is five of these guys, Indiana Jones and the crew, are in this military dock, and it's in the river, and the old crazy guy Ox goes, "It will drop three times." At which point, Indiana Jones points out to everybody that by drop, he means waterfall. And you're talking about these big 100-foot, 200-foot waterfalls, and they go over three of these things. And there's not a scratch on any of them. I know this is supposed to be an action flick, but there's only so far that you can suspend your disbelief. What are the chances you can go over Niagara Falls three times, exposed, and not get hurt?
The amphibious vehicle that they're in is destroyed, and this is an armor-plated boat on wheels. Dashed to smithereens, and they crawl out of the water and go, "Oh, that was a nice little bath. What's next?"
What I'm really saying is, in a movie about aliens or extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional beings, whatever they're supposed to be, what I'm having problems with is not the extra-dimensional beings, it's the superhero Indiana Jones who can't possibly get hurt. I mean, even Superman would get hurt doing the things that Indiana Jones does in this movie. In my own mind, using the Indiana Jones mythology, I've come up with my half-reason why he could survive all this. And that's because in the third movie, he has the cup of Christ, and it's supposed to make people immortal, which would have been just a really good answer to say, you know, Indiana Jones is going to live forever. Except for the fact they used the Holy Grail to save his father's life in The Last Crusade and killed him off in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Which is another one of my major complaints about this movie. Just because Sean Connery was just so phenomenal. Okay, he didn't want to do this film. I understand that. And I understand why they felt the need. But just because they felt the need to do so doesn't mean that they should have killed off the character. The lesson that he learned from losing his father could easily have been learned just by the loss of Marcus Brody, who's also dead at the beginning of this film.
Well, I think more than just writing off Sean Connery in the character of Henry Jones Sr., what they really lost was the opportunity to expand Indiana Jones' character. It's more to show how Indiana Jones has spent his entire life being alone. He's had friends, he's got professional colleagues, but essentially he spends his entire life alone. So they had this opportunity to show here he is an old man. He's lost his mentor, Marcus Brody. He's lost his father, Henry Jones Sr. And he had this opportunity to have this realization, I have spent my whole life searching for artifacts, and I've missed the one thing that was most important, the family. Okay, he gets married, he has a son in this movie, but it's completely glossed over. If all this wasn't bad enough, we come to Industrial Light and Magic. Just as George Lucas created Star Wars, and Steven Spielberg created these brilliant blockbuster masterpieces, Industrial Light and Magic really created the Hollywood CGI. They are the masters of their art. I haven't seen CGI this bad since Ang Lee's Incredible Hulk, and I actually preferred the special effects in Ang Lee's Hulk.
I understand not wanting to take your 60-year-old star and dangle him over the side of a cliff in a moving vehicle. But the CGI green screen work in that entire scene in the jungle, well, the fact that we were able to sit there and go, ooh, that's CGI, and ooh, that was bad CGI, says something. The whole purpose behind modern day CGI is to use it and not make it evident that you use CGI. We should have been able to look at that scene and go, wow, they hung their 60-year-old star in a moving vehicle off the side of a cliff. How did they do that? That wasn't there. We sat there and went, ooh, CGI.
There was a total absence of magic from Industrial Light and Magic in this one. The same jungle scene, there's a sword fight between Cate Blanchett and Shia LaBeouf. And it's one of those scenes where it's like, cut, 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 cut. But it's so painfully obvious between cut live action, cut CGI, cut live action, cut CGI, that almost makes you dizzy. It was terrible.
It was almost cartoonish. It took me out of the action-adventure genre, and for me, it was more like a cartoon than Speed Racer was.
Speed Racer was certainly more honest about it. Speed Racer basically said, this is a total fantasy, don't have to believe these places, it's just a fantasy story. Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls was trying to say, this is the real world, and these are events that could have happened in the real world, and yet they all look like they're painted. And that's even giving it too much credit. The matte paintings in Star Wars are better than the CGI in Crystal Skull.
For you, it was the CGI. For me, the worst part, again, comes back to the continuity within the universe. The idea of having these artifacts that are supernatural in quality, in some case in biblical proportions and in other cases in mystical proportions, I have no problem with that. That is set within the parameters of the universe. This one is removed from the supernatural and is placed squarely into the extra-dimensional. It goes from being fantasy to science fiction. And when movies jump genres like that, there is a detriment to it. The fact that the crystal skulls are aliens from another dimension was really a detriment to me as far as the storyline goes. I would much rather have seen them pick a mystical artifact and stuck with the mystical aspects of things than going for this science fiction-y, otherworld plotline.
It certainly didn't distract me as much as it did you. I think part of that's because I was familiar with the Crystal Skulls before I saw the movie, and so this was part of what I would consider a fantasy mythology anyways.
I understand that part of this Mayan mythology crystal skull thing has always entailed aliens slash extra-dimensional beings. the fact that they were broadcasting this as a science fiction related artifact from the moment that they were in Area 51, and what the bad guys are looking for is the alien corpse. It just felt wrong. It didn't feel like part of the Indiana Jones mythology. It felt like X-Files.
That's a really good point. Maybe what they're doing is trying to appeal to the X-File audience.
I never really got X-Files, which may be the reason why I didn't really get into this. I remember 10 years ago finding on the internet a script slash proposal for a new Indiana Jones movie. And it's amazing to me how that treatment had a lot of similarities to Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls, except for In the Way of the Artifact. It had The Return of Marion. It had Indy's Son. It even had The Death of Henry Jones Sr. But in a lot of ways, I thought that that treatment was a superior film concept. It dealt more with the idea of an elderly Indiana Jones who's feeling the fact that he's alone and coming to the realization not only that he's alone, but that he needs somebody else in his life. I thought it had a better artifact. It went back to biblical again and had him searching for Noah's Ark. Admittedly, it wouldn't have been as action-packed as this film was, but I thought that it had a better story to it. And in a lot of ways, I almost wish that they had gone with that treatment rather than this one.
It's still the intellectual property of Lucas and Spielberg, so really they get the final call on where they want the series to go.
So you've mentioned a couple of scenes that you would like to see chopped out. I've mentioned a few parts of the movie that I thought this movie would have been better without. Just because this is the product that got released to theaters doesn't mean that it will end up being the final product. We are talking about Lucas here.
I think that's a really good point. We got Star Wars Special Editions and the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles released on DVD.
Star Wars has gone under the editing knife at least 3 times. Each one released with Lucas's brand of, this is what I really wanted to see happen. The first Star Wars, when released, was not Star Wars A New Hope. It was Star Wars.
Then the scroll said Episode 4, A New Hope. And to debate the point that the story was always about Darth Vader, the first licensed product, Splinter in the Mind's Eye, specifically says on the cover, The Further Adventures of Luke Skywalker.
Lucas is becoming renowned for his revisionist history. 25 years ago, Star Wars was all about Luke Skywalker. There was no debate as to who the lead character was. When Star Wars A Phantom Menace was released, suddenly Lucas is saying, no, the lead character wasn't ever really Luke Skywalker. This was more the story of Anakin Skywalker and his rise and fall. I'm sorry, I kind of looked at the TV and went, what? You want the bad guy to be the featured character?
Before The Phantom Menace came out, he said Star Wars was part of a 9-episode epic until Episode 1 came out, and he said, no, it was really always 6.
And it happens with Indiana Jones as well. The first movie, as we've been referring to it through this entire broadcast, was Raiders of the Lost Ark, until they've recently been released on DVD, at which point it became Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's revised the title of the movie because he wants it to flow more in this trilogy. Honestly, I don't think that really makes a big difference because I remember that the first of the Rambo movies was not called Rambo, it was called First Blood. But the pinnacle of his revisionist history has arrived with the release of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, otherwise known as The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones. The show was a 1-hour weekly telecast that hopped around in chronological order. One week it would be Indy as a 9-year-old, the next week it would be Indy as a 16-year-old, and it would bop around. Then the DVD set comes out, and it is now a series of 2 to 2.5-hour movies that are in chronological order of Indy's lifetime.
And to add insult to injury, the original 1-hour episodes were actually bookend with elderly Indiana Jones. He always had somebody that he had to say, oh, let me tell you about the time I, flowing into the story, ending with the person going, wow, you really changed my life. This actor's been completely cut out of these DVD movies.
But enough of ripping George Lucas to shreds. Do we want to rip any more into this movie?
I have a small complaint with John Williams' score also. From a conductor who has created iconic works, the E.T. theme, the Indiana Jones theme, the Star Wars theme, the Superman theme, the score for this movie sounded incredibly rehashed. It sounded like, you know, I'm going to take a little bit of Star Wars, a little bit of Indiana Jones, a little bit of E.T. I'm just going to throw it all together. Nobody will notice it's the same music.
In bringing that up, I'll mention the fact that this entire film felt like one giant massaging of ego. I almost feel that it should be called Indiana Jones and the Stroke Fest. You mentioned the car from American Graffiti. The alien in the end, as I saw him, I was waiting for him to extend his index finger and for it to start glowing. John Williams reusing his scores, and I'm sure that some people are going to look at this and go, wow, isn't it so fantastic that they paid tribute to all these former pieces that came before it, and isn't that so wonderful? Honestly, the first 5 or 6 times, I thought, hey, that's pretty cool. By the time we hit number 20, I was going, oh my god, can you write something original, please?
Everything is so telegraphed in this. The jokes are telegraphed. The punchlines are telegraphed. The plot lines are telegraphed. But they kind of say, remember, we did this movie too.
And like I said, there were times where it was cute. When Marion uses the exact same dialogue when she first lays eyes on Indy in this movie as she used when she first laid eyes on him in the first movie, I thought that was kind of cute and clever. But it would have been better if that had been the rarity rather than the regular occasion. Speaking of Marion, it was wonderful to see Karen Allen back in an Indiana Jones film. I have nothing bad to say about Harrison Ford. Shia LaBeouf was decent. The 20-something actor was a lot less believable as an action star than the 60-year-old actor. But then again, the 60-year-old actor was Indiana Jones.
I don't think there were any performances that were poorly done. I still don't understand where Shia LaBeouf came from. He's a guy that somebody in Hollywood has the Shia LaBeouf button. It's like the Staples Easy button. Oh, we want an actor in a movie. Yep, Shia LaBeouf!
I don't feel as though he's the most talented actor in Hollywood, but he's also no Keanu Reeves.
That's a low blow. He's no Hayden Christensen. I mean, he's really not a terrible actor. At the same time, he's no Marlon Brando, so I don't get why he's a superstar. I won't not see a movie because he's in it, but I'm never going to go say, oh, another Shia LaBeouf movie, I gotta see that! Kate Blanchett, just marvelous, like always. It's too bad that she was the bad guy. I wouldn't mind seeing a spinoff movie with her in it.
The Soviet big tough guy, whose character I don't think we ever were told what his real name was, he was a little two-dimensional, but I can't really blame that on the actor. I think that was the writing. I mean, come on, the fact is that I can't tell you what his character's name was.
He was Thug Number One. He did Thug Number One really well. It was not important what his name was.
Although I will say that he has one of the most grotesque death scenes that I've seen in a long time. That was just sick.
That's actually a really good point about where the movies have gone. In Raiders of the Lost Ark is actually probably the grossest death scene I have ever seen in any movie, and they never showed it. You see the propellers heading towards the Nazi thug, then you see the cockpit of the airplane get splattered with blood, and you just have to fill in the blanks. Thug Number One dying in the fire ant pit was both disgusting and hilarious at the same time.
I think that that death even gives the melting faces from Raiders of the Lost Ark a run for its money.
I agree with you completely. It was just the ew factor.
He had more of an ew factor than Cate Blanchett's character.
I would say he probably had the ew factor for all four movies. Again, they did really go for the lowbrow factor a couple of times. More than a couple of times.
During that sword fight, Shia LaBeouf getting hit in the groin multiple times by the bushes.
Yeah, the first time, you laugh, and you cover your groin, and you go, oh! And the second time, you went, all right, that was funny the first time. And the third time, you're like, I got it the first time. And then, again, and again, and again. Yeah, it was overdone.
Which I think is a good summation of this film. It takes good things, and it overdoes them. It takes a good thing too far.
I think that people get the idea that this was not a thrilling movie. This is not a great action adventure. It wasn't a great comedy. It was mediocre. If you're still in the early summer of 2008 and you want to see a great movie, go see Iron Man. If you want to see a movie that'll have you on the edge of your seats and it's just a fun action romp, go see Speed Racer. If you've seen those, go see Indiana Jones.
Wait, if you've seen those two and you've seen Prince Caspian, then go see Indiana Jones. I've seen that one and you haven't yet.
Again, not absolutely horrific. I give it 2 pens in the pocket protector. Just mediocre and really hard to live up to Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
I will say it's still an early summer. I'm sure that there's going to be things that are going to be far worse than this released. I'll agree with you. 2 pens in the pocket protector. Other news in Twerp, we're still hoping that Matt might get Act 3 of Eras out by end of May, beginning of June. We're hoping to get I'm One 4 out by mid-June, and we're hoping to get the first episode of Geist out end of June, beginning of July. So we're hoping to have a rather productive summer, so stick with us. Check in with us next time for our anniversary episode. Doug, can you believe we've been doing this for almost a year now?
How much longer is our sentence?
We do want to thank you for listening.
And as always, we would like to hear your comments and or feedback. Please write Jim at twerponline.net.
Twerpcast has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions. Copyright 2008. See you next time.